Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Jessen, Judge Larkin, Judge Riley, the Honorable Judge Jessen presiding. Before the court is case A20-0537, Daniel J. Cafferty v. Mille Lacs Health System.
Good morning and welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals on this, the September 23rd, 2020. This is the second two oral arguments we're conducting today versus in Zoom.gov. The rules, and I know you've appeared before us before, but via Zoom are very similar to those in our courtroom. So each party will have 15 minutes for their argument. Counsel for appellant, you'll have an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal. I'd ask yourself when you begin your argument to state your name so that we have that clear for our audio recording. And you'll also notice on the screen we have a clock so that we so you'll be able to keep track of time. And with that, counsel for appellant, I'll turn to you.
Thank you, Your Honor. Brandon Thompson here today on behalf of the appellant, Daniel Cafferty. May it please the court. There are essentially two issues involved in the argument before the court here today. And there's really two kind of principles that were implicated by the trial court's decision below. I'm going to talk about both of them, but I'm going to focus my attention only on one. The first issue is the judgment as a matter of law. I don't intend to spend a great deal of time rehashing all of the evidence that we briefed, because I think we were pretty thorough in the briefing. The bottom line is this: we have juries for a reason. Case was tried to a jury. Jury verdicts are not supposed to be overturned unless there is no theory of the evidence that could support the jury's verdict. And in determining whether there's a reasonable theory of the evidence that could support a jury's verdict, the trial court is supposed to take all reasonable inferences in favor of the verdict. The trial court below just didn't do that. And I don't think there's any question that the trial court below didn't do that. As we outline in great detail in the brief, there are at least a half a dozen different theories of the evidence that would have supported the jury's verdict in this case. Certainly the jury could have come down a different way, but they didn't. And that's why we have juries. And it's my position that any one of those reasonable theories of the evidence that we laid out in the briefs would sustain the jury's verdict and should lead this court to reverse the trial court's grant of judgment as a matter of law and reinstate the verdict.
So, Mr. Thompson, if I may.
Yeah.
I mean, I understand that the respondent here is advocating for a pretty high level of specificity in the expert testimony. And I know it's not always possible to pinpoint things, but to globally assign blame to nursing staff without other than one naming them, that low bar concerns me. So where's the theory? You've talked about all these different theories that the jury could have. Where's one where that wouldn't be a concern?
The case sure, well,
is to me.
The simplest one would be for this court to simply uphold the jury's verdict on the reasonable theory of the evidence that Nurse Skurr was causally negligent. And we talked about that in the brief. And so if that is the concern of the court, you could still uphold the jury's verdict based solely on the testimony that was specifically given with respect to Nurse Skurr's negligence. And we talked about that in the briefing. I mean, she failed to communicate information that a reasonable juror could certainly have concluded should have been communicated. And there was a whole host of different ways that the jury could have concluded that that failure alone contributed substantially to Mrs. Cafferty's death. And there was clear, unequivocal expert testimony to that effect that was admitted without objection. So if that is the concern of the court, then my suggestion would be simply uphold the verdict based on the conclusion that the jury could have found Nurse Skurr causally negligent, and that in and of itself would be grounds for upholding the jury's verdict. But as a more general matter, I do want to respond to this heightened level of specificity that respondents are advocating and that the trial court seemed to embrace. And I'm going to use a different type of case in order, I think, to illustrate the absurdity of that requirement. No case that respondents have cited or that the trial court cited, or certainly that I'm aware of, has ever required the level of specificity being sought here, that in order to find somebody negligent, there has to be specific testimony that a specific person on a specific time engaged in one specific act of conduct that, if that hadn't have happened, would have prevented this outcome. That's but-for causation. It's not the way the law works. And let's use the example of a car accident case to sort of illustrate the point. Let's say that somebody drinks too much, they speed, they run a red light, and they run over a pedestrian and kill them. The plaintiff would not be obligated to prove that the specific act of speeding was negligent and would have, if he hadn't been speeding, then he wouldn't have killed the pedestrian. Plaintiff doesn't even have to prove that the speeding in and of itself was a substantial contributing cause of the death. Same thing with running the red light or drinking too much before the person drove. In the vast majority of cases, an allegation of negligence involves multiple conduct, multiple acts of conduct that taken as a whole are both negligent and as a whole contributed substantially to the outcome. Same thing here. I think Judge Riley might be trying to ask a question and she's muted.
Unmute.
Judge Riley.
Is that good? Okay, thanks. So here it's a Med-Mal case though, and you have the affidavits from the experts, and your affidavits start out generally with what happened medically and talked in general terms about aspiration and all kinds of things, and then went to four specific people, the three doctors and the one nurse. And it seems that as you got towards the end of the trial, and I'll tell you, I've read most of the trial transcript, but not every single word of it, but it seemed like your theory of the case moved around a bit, that initially there was a focus on, I'll just call her Nurse Rena because I don't, not sure how to pronounce her last name. But then when the forensic pathologist said, no, it looks like the aspirations took place at least 2 days before and over a course of time, that's when maybe the focus changed, I'm not sure. And so the car accident case is interesting, but I don't think it's necessarily applicable to a Med-Mal trial, even though negligence is negligence.
Sure. So there's obviously a number of things to respond to with respect to that series of questions. First of all, the car accident case, I think, more is just directed towards the general idea of what a plaintiff is expected to prove in a negligence case. It's conduct as a whole is a substantial contributing cause to an injury. With respect to the question about the theory of the case sort of evolving over time, first of all, I will say that I don't know that interpretation of what happened at the trial is necessarily fair. I talked in the opening statement about the fact that all of the nursing staff was negligent and that this woman was aspirating multiple times over multiple days. Nobody noticed it. Nobody did anything about it. And that really was the testimony from all of the experts. So it wasn't the case, I don't think, that the theory of the case sort of evolved over time. But even if you assume that it did, with respect to the judgment as a matter of law issue, certainly theories of the case develop as the evidence develops over time. With respect to the JMOL issue, the only question is, was there testimony that could have led a reasonable jury to find that one or more nurses was negligent? There's no question that there was testimony on that, and neither the trial court nor respondents seemed to deny that. And that conduct contributed substantially to Mrs. Cafferty's death.
Well, that brings me, did I just mute myself again? Can you hear me? Okay.
Yeah.
So that brings me to your second issue. And let's assume that we agree with you that the judge shouldn't have granted the JMOL, but then he conditionally granted a new trial. And you said that's where you were going to focus your arguments when you gave your introduction. And so the standard there on review, which is where we are, is an abuse of discretion. And he seemed to say, as he watched the whole trial come in, that the defendants or the respondents in here had been surprised and that it had been unfair to them. And so I'm trying to wrap my mind around the standard of review, abuse of discretion, and how the judge abused his discretion.
Sure. So, and now that I'm almost two thirds of the way through my initial argument, I'm glad we got to the part that I said I was going to focus on. So there's really two prongs to this as well. Your Honor is correct that with respect to the judge's analysis of whether there was unfair surprise that warrants a new trial, it is an abuse of discretion standard. But this court doesn't even have to get there. Because before you get to the question of whether the judge abused his discretion in ruling on the question of whether surprise warranted a new trial, we first have to answer the question of whether that is a proper issue on which a new trial could be granted. Under the rules of evidence and a long-standing list of cases, both from this court and from the Minnesota Supreme Court, they had an obligation to object to that testimony that was supposedly an unfair surprise in order for it to be grounds for them to claim that they are entitled to a new trial. They just didn't do that. And in the briefing, respondent does an admirable job of trying to kind of skirt around what really is the core issue there. And that's this. Number one, what the trial court concluded is that the unfair prejudice that warranted a new trial was the admission of expert testimony by Dr. Balin and Dr. Sweet, critical of the nursing staff in general. And respondents acknowledge that on page 32 of their brief. That is their claim of error. The claim of error is not that the judge inappropriately instructed the jurors on whether they could consider the negligence of the nursing staff as a whole, because the instructions are supposed to follow the evidence at trial. They're supposed to reflect the evidence at trial. So the error that the trial court granted the new trial on, and the error that they are claiming entitles them to a new trial here, was the admission of the testimony. They haven't even tried to argue that they objected to the admission of that testimony.
So if I may, Mr. Thompson, when I looked at the record, and I'm sure you all know it better than I do, but I did see it, they made a motion for directed verdict, you know, based a lot on this very scope argument, what I would call a scope argument, right? And even though they didn't object, as I read it during Dr. Sweet and Dr., I think it was Balin's testimony, this was raised, I think, before Dr. Balin's testimony, after Dr. Sweet's testimony, once again, the scope issue they're raising. I mean, so do they have to use the word object? They were obviously complaining about it. They moved for a directed verdict based upon it.
Well,
so, to get away from the abuse of discretion, do they actually have to use the words I object?
Sure. What the cases say, and I'll point the court to State versus Fenney, 448 Northwest 2nd, 54. That's the Supreme Court, 1989. They've got to object to the testimony. It is not enough for them to talk with the judge before the testimony is going to come out and have what this court and the Supreme Court has referred to as sort of broad-based, non-specific complaints about the scope of testimony. They had an obligation to actually object. And if I may, they don't point to anything in the transcript that they claim was anything resembling an objection until the charge conference. And so with all respect, Judge Jessen, to your review of the transcript, I disagree with it. But more importantly, respondents themselves have argued in their briefing that they did not object, nor did they even have an obligation to object until the charge conference. And that is just fundamentally inconsistent with both Rule of Evidence 103 and in black letter law in the state of Minnesota. You cannot let multiple experts testify to something that you think is inappropriate. Let it happen, wait until the very end of the trial and then complain about it in the charge conference. And obviously I take issue with even the question that there was a specific objection in the charge conference, but even if you assume there was.
I was gonna ask you about that because I looked at that and I didn't see a specific objection, but you know, they're also referring to a lot of, well, there's this SIP jigs and different things. And so maybe I missed it somehow. Was there an objection from your perspective to the special verdict form? I'm asking one at a time, was there?
Yeah, no. I don't think there was. There was a discussion about the instruction. There was a discussion about the special verdict form. There was no objection. And as I pointed out in the briefing, both sides knew how to make a specific objection to something if they thought it was inappropriate, because defendant's trial counsel was very specific in her objections, not only to the jury instructions and the special verdict form, but also to the curative instruction. And there she did do what the rules of evidence require her to do, which is make a specific objection and get a specific ruling from the court with respect to this supposedly undisclosed testimony. It never happened.
Before we move to Ms. McBride, I just want to ask the panel if they have further questions for Mr. Thompson at this point. Okay. With that, Ms. McBride, we turn to you.
Good afternoon, court, counsel, Kate McBride here on behalf of MLHS, the respondent. The jury is permitted to make reasonable inferences that begin drawn from the evidence, but it is evidence that separates reasonable inference from speculation. And the evidence in a medical malpractice case has to come from an expert, and that is, what is the standard of care? Who violated it? How and when was it violated? And how did that breach cause the outcome? That is what is required of plaintiff for their burden of proof. Plaintiff's argument that he has no obligation to be specific about those things, I would say that the Maudsley case is the perfect retort to that argument, and it is a false argument. There, this court said, when an expert said, well, if the treatment had been on June 27th instead of June 28th, she wouldn't have lost her vision. This court said that's not specific enough, and this court significantly contrast Maudsley with Blatz and Demgen. In Blatz, there was that opinion that reached that level of specificity that is required. In Blatz, the expert said, every second is critical when one is deprived of oxygen, and they needed to resuscitate this woman within 5 minutes of the paramedics being there. In Demgen, again, Maudsley says that's the level of specificity required. There, the expert opinion said the C-section needed to be done within 53 minutes of a certain time frame, and the failure to do so by the specific defendant caused the outcome. As this court is no doubt already aware, plaintiff's record citations do not come anywhere close to the level of specificity required. They don't even come close to what Maudsley was. Plaintiff argues, well, the nursing staff failed to notice she was aspirating, but there is no evidence whatsoever that any nurse witnessed her choking and did nothing or withheld anything from the doctors. Dr. Sweet actually states—
But Ms. McBride, you have her son saying that they saw her choking and told a nurse.
That's actually—
On occasion.
That's actually not what the son, and let me be clear, plaintiff sometimes says sons, but it was one son. And if you look at page 355 and 364, he specifically says she was not choking. He says, you know, when you're, puking and you have trouble breathing, you know how it is when you're puking, basically, he says, and she was doing that. And I told a nurse, but significantly there, what nurse? What did that nurse see? What did that nurse do? How was what she saw or do or did not do a breach of the standard of care? And how did that incident, when we don't even know when it happened, how did that cause the outcome? We don't have that. We have nothing. We have no evidence. And that brings it within the realm of speculation. The other, that's under the notice allegation. Well, plaintiff also talks about, well, the nurses failed to prevent. But it's not enough that nurses can generally do things. There's testimony on that. But what did someone fail to do? And how and when did that happen? Plaintiff says on page 9 of his reply, in a very passive voice, which I think is very telling here, it's like, folks, all the things that should have been done. And here are my citations. Well, plaintiff cites to Dr. Sweet's testimony, 385 to 393. But if you look on that, the Dr. Sweet was talking about the doctor's responsibilities when oxat rates decrease, such as get an arterial blood gas, order a CT of the abdomen and chest x-ray, don't prescribe sedatives, order that the patient be NPO, order a CBC, prescribe steroids and antibiotics. And then the other site is to Dr. Balin, a transcript 543 to 546. In that section, Dr. Balin is criticizing the prescription for Valium, doctor's order of the prescriptions. I think it's very telling that the three things that plaintiff has sort of grabbed onto is whether she was NPO, the angle of her bed, and narcotics. But I think it's very interesting to look at the actual testimony, and there's no evidence there about the nurses. Dr. Balin says the doctors, and this is on page 562, the doctors changed the ER NPO order. So the doctors immediately—
if I may, if there wasn't foundation for the expert opinions about the nurses, because they did give expert opinions saying nurses reach the standard of care, why didn't you object to the foundation of those opinions?
The time to object to whether they satisfied their burden of proof and whether they have the whether they have made a factual foundation is at the time of the JMOL. I mean, these opinions that came in. So when Dr. Sweet on page 552 said—
But Ms. McBride, I tried a lot of Med-Mal cases as a trial court judge, and it was common for the attorneys to object that the expert doctors were going outside of their opinions or going beyond their opinions.
Sure.
And that didn't happen here.
And that, of course, goes to the new trial, but it doesn't go to the ultimate issue as to whether ultimately in the end, did the plaintiff satisfy their burden of proof? So there really are two separate issues here.
Let's get to the new trial issue, because sure. Mr. Thompson said that it was hard to find where you objected to different things. And I looked at the charge conference and special verdict forms that had been submitted by everyone, and it's hard for me to find where you objected to the jigs as they came in and to the special verdict form as it was given to the jury.
Well, with regard to that issue, I see that there's no serious doubt that the plaintiff's experts did not disclose before trial. When there was the initial discussion about Dr. Larson and this is leading up to that, as to where we were, where our mindset was, where trial counsel's thoughts were, the initial discussion before trial was about the creative theory that Dr. Larson could still be held liable, even though she had, or MLHS could still be vicariously liable for Dr. Larson, even though she settled. At that time, at no time did plaintiff say during that discussion that he's changing his theory and adding defendants that had not been identified. And there was a lot of discussion about Narsher, and at no time did counsel say, you know what, wait a minute here, I've got another surprise twist for you. I'm adding in a new claim here. So also what I think is important to know, and what is it's very significant, is that when she aspirated was still at issue. So counsel told the court, I want to be able to talk about the totality of her care. And the response by defense counsel was the care is what the care is. We're going to be talking about the totality of her care. When she aspirated was at issue, it is not here now. So in fact, the care of Dr. Larson, the care of Dr. Petrofitta was at issue. Those were all being discussed. What happened? When did it happen? And at no point does a defendant have an obligation to tell plaintiff, you're not satisfying your burden of proof here. I'm going to tip you off and tell you, you need to do a better job of asking these questions and be more specific and stick to the claims. I will say that there was, in fact, there was a discussion and counsel did make her position known on page 1244 that she opposed any changing of the jury instruction from nurse to nurses because there was no claim, as you've pointed out, that there was no claim before trial that this was ever at issue. What was at issue is the totality of her care. It was only then that plaintiff argued that MLHS could be vicariously liable for those nurses.
If I may, Ms. McBride, it seems to me that if you're going to later say, look, there was this whole new theory and we didn't know about it and it was trial by ambush, so we need a conditional new trial, then the first you heard about it, you should be objecting. And I read the plaintiff's opening statement and he was talking about the liability of nurses generally, not just one. So why, starting then, didn't you raise that objection?
Again, I think that the mindset of trial counsel at that point was that, yes, we're going to talk about the totality of her care, but there are only two people who were named specifically in that, and the jury's going to be later told they have to decide was Nurse Kerr or was Dr. Donovan. But all of that, and I can't emphasize this enough, all of that is irrelevant to the fact that, okay, this came in. Even if counsel should have, even if this court were to find that the new trial motion, that there should have been an earlier objection, it does not take away from the fact that plaintiff simply did not satisfy his burden with regard to the nursing staff. The plaintiff has the burden, and there was no evidence that the nursing staff, that there was any specificity that the nursing staff caused the outcome. There is nothing. There is the NPO order. Both Drs. Larson and Donovan said, we did not have her NPO. Dr. Larson said, I had her on chips and sips from the beginning. In the expert's disclosure, Dr. Sweet at paragraph 11 said, Dr. Larson had her on clear liquids. Dr. Sweet's paragraph 11 and Balin's 45, they said the orders that doctors should give were angling the bed, NPO, and avoid narcotics. Same thing, the breach was that Dr. Larson's and Dr. Donovan didn't keep her or delayed putting her on NPO. There is nothing in the record that says this nurse, who is part of the nursing staff, did this and this caused the outcome. Even with regard to whether her bed should be angled, even if there is testimony out there that nurses can generally do that, no one said, in fact, this is what Dr. Balin said at 546, quote, setting up her lying flat was setting up a situation for an aspiration to occur. That is inherently vague. There's no testimony that this actually did happen or that it happened because of this, or when it occurred or how that occurred. It violates what this court has said is the required level of specificity that you need to prove your burden of proof. And that is Maudsley, that's Blatz, that's Demkin, that's Knowles, that's Lubner. Over and over and over again, the Supreme Court and this court have said, you need to say who did what, when, and how did that cause it. The answers, significantly, I would point you to page 452 and 524 524 and 452, when counsel is asking a question, the broad and general questions using the word nursing staff, Jig 1025 says an attorney's questions is not evidence. The answer correct or yes by the expert does not then say what ways did the nursing staff violate the standard of care and how did that cause? And that is extremely important here because that is what's lacking. And if that's lacking, you don't even get to the new trial motion The generalized folks questions that counsel made is just an intentional obfuscation to mask this weakness. Just because he was able to convince the jury does not equal proof. The trial court's job is to determine if the evidence supports the verdict. And this court did that in a thorough and dispassionate review, even after ruling in plaintiff's favor throughout trial. Once the court who sat through this trial looked at the evidence and thought, you're right, there is no evidence. With regard to Nurse Burr, Dr. Sweet said that transfer needed to happen on 6/20 because her dilation was pronounced. She was at increased risk. The transfer to the higher level of care would have prevented this from happening. And that the fact that it didn't later caused her chemical pneumonia and damaged her lungs irreparably. If the afternoon of 6/20 was the critical time frame to prevent that outcome, then, and as a matter of law, but anything happening after that cannot be a legal cause. It's les jeux sont faits. It's the die are cast, the chips of that was the moment, and nothing after that could have changed it. The retort to that is, well, they could have given her antibiotics. But again, just like every other piece of evidence, there's no expert that says this is when this happened and this is when antibiotics would have made a difference and you didn't do it. For this reason, I would ask the court to affirm the judgment in favor of the defendants and in the alternative order a new trial. Thank you.
Any other questions from the panel? Then we'll turn to you, Mr. Thompson, for your rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. With respect to Nurse Skurr, I think that's important because all this court needs is one reasonable theory of the evidence to overturn the grant of JMOL. There was evidence that she was negligent in failing to tell Dr. Donovan that Mrs. Cafferty was throwing up tan-colored, foul-smelling liquid the night before she was transferred. Even Dr. Donovan, in her deposition, admitted that that was negligence. There was a mountain of testimony that that was below the standard of care. The jury could easily have concluded that that led to at least a 15-hour delay in administering antibiotics. Every medical witness in this case, including the experts that Mille Lacs called, testified that antibiotics are critical when you suspect that somebody is aspirating. One of their experts even testified that antibiotics are supposed to be given the minute you suspect that somebody is aspirating. The jury then heard Dr. Sweet testify that he was 100% confident that Mrs. Cafferty would have survived if somebody at Mille Lacs had noticed she was aspirating and they had given her antibiotics.
What period of time was he referring to? Was he talking about that that night before the transfer?
Yeah, so he wasn't, in that line of questioning, he wasn't being specific as to the specific time period. That is one of those areas where the jury is allowed to and can draw inferences. And they can use the totality of the evidence that was before them, like, for example, the fact that Mille Lacs argued over and over again that Mrs. Cafferty looked great. She looked perfectly fine at the time they transferred her. And a short time later, when she got down to the cities, she was on death's doorstep. The jury absolutely could conclude that a 15-hour delay in the administration of antibiotics, which everybody agreed was the most important thing you can do for somebody who is suspected of aspirating, contributed substantially to the outcome in this case. But again, that's just one of many theories of negligence that would support the jury's conclusion in this case. And the bottom line is, in order to rule as the trial court did, this court would have to embrace a world where the jury is not allowed to make any inferences at all. We all know that that's not the law. And Maudsley, as Ms. McBride hangs her hat on Maudsley, it's a totally different situation. In Maudsley, the only opinion with respect to causation was, well, if it would have been done a day earlier, that would have made a difference because earlier is better. Literally, that was the only thing that was in that affidavit. By the way, this wasn't a JMOL. It was a question of the sufficiency of a Rule 145 affidavit. All it said was earlier is better. And defense lawyers in malpractice cases have been using Maudsley ever since to try to argue that, oh, all the plaintiff is saying here is that earlier is better. It's not what Sweet and Balin here were saying at all. They explained in great detail the physiological process by which breathing in your own vomit leads to chemical pneumonitis, which leads to respiratory failure, which can cause somebody to die, which is exactly what happened to Mrs. Cafferty. And none of my experts are required to pinpoint the exact moment in time where there was a point of no return. No case stands for that proposition. At best, that is but-for causation. It's not the law in Minnesota. What the plaintiff has to prove is that the negligence was a substantial contributing cause of Mrs. Cafferty's death. There was a mountain of evidence by which the jury could reach that conclusion. As we turn again to the question about whether they preserved this for appeal, I think it is very telling that when Judge Jessen asked Ms. McBride to tell her where is the objection, she wasn't able to find it. The only thing she pointed to was page 1244 of the transcript, which, by the way, they didn't cite in their brief. They cited a different part of the transcript, and we actually pointed out that the closest they could possibly argue that they came was on 1244, but there's no objection. All there was the judge explaining what it was that he was planning to do, and Mille Lacs' trial counsel didn't object. But even if they had objected then, that was way too late in the game, because by then the jury had already heard the criticisms of the nursing staff, because it was allowed by the trial court without objection from the defense. The time to object to something like that is not during the charge conference. The defense has the obligation, if they don't want the jury to hear a piece of evidence, they got to object to it when it comes out. And if they let it come in over and over and over again, it's in the case and the jury can use it to draw conclusions, which is exactly what they did here.
Well, thank you both very much for your helpful and well done arguments and briefing. We will take the matter under advisement and issue an opinion within the statutory time. Thank you both.